Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today's January 5th. And what you're going to hear today is a portion of a 5+ hour live show that Osborne and I recorded on Friday. And for a little less than 2 of those 5 hours, we were joined by Jeffrey Tucker, who has been on the show before. Jeffrey's projects include Laissez-Faire Books, LFB.org, and a new project called Liberty.me that we're going to discuss in some detail on the show today. Now, there are two parts of this, and let me explain what my thinking is. I invited Jeffrey on the show after I heard he walked out of what I was so sure was going to be my all-time favorite movie, The Wolf of Wall Street. And I immediately went to see it, and I think right at around the same time that I was making plans to go see the movie, I was inviting him on the show to have what I envisioned to be some kind of a debate about not just the merits of the film, but also its message, because I've been a little bit down on the whole Wall Street scene, obviously, for some time, even though I recognize that the stock market, in its purest form, serves an important function. So I was hoping that would generate some interesting discussion. I will hold off on talking about the film in any way. The next show will be 255, School Sucks at the Movies, The Wolf of Wall Street with Jeffrey Tucker. But like The Wolf of Wall Street, I will say this. The conversation expanded beyond what I needed it to be, which in this case with Jeffrey Tucker is great. You know, like I thought we would hit on this topic maybe for a solid hour, but you know, there was just so much, we were both feeding off each other so much that the discussion went in different ways. Osborne obviously was with us too, so a lot of things happened. Very interesting discussion. So what I've decided to include today is 2 outtakes from that conversation that I believe actually form a coherent conversation. And the edit point will be clear. I'll put in a beep. But what is removed from this is the actual Wolf of Wall Street discussion. And by putting these outtakes out first, I think it'll maybe give you a better sense of where Jeffrey is coming from on this topic. And where I'm coming from on this topic, and hopefully the next discussion will make even more sense. That's my thinking. But I was so happy to have him. We might do another live show together at the Liberty Forum, which is coming up, I believe, at the end of next month. So that's it. I want to spend some more time editing and producing, you know, the next show, and it's going to be a very hectic first half of the week here because I'm headed to Keene. So, you know, bear with me. More stuff is coming soon. Please go to YouTube and check out the video I just put out, The Dumbing Down of America, it's called. It's a little interlude in the John Taylor Gatto series. 20+ hours of work, so I hope you'll watch it. So anyway, that's it. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy this conversation, and I will have that Wolf of Wall Street show ready and out as soon as possible. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Ooh, I've got a little wave file here called Jeffrey Tucker Intro. Let's see what that is.
Don't let school take you out of the real world. Never lose touch with what's going on outside of the classroom. One of the big problems we face is that kids are taken out of anything resembling a real world for 4 years for college, and they've lost that perceptive power of entrepreneurship because they don't have any connection to what's really going on in the real world anymore. Don't let school take you out of the real world.
I wanted to ask you a question because I know you're a very positive guy. You're very optimistic, and I felt myself being a little bit cynical lately. And I try to do. I have 2 projects going on simultaneously. I'm trying to do a podcast that is practical value, right? Where people can go and they can say, "Oh, well, I'll download this series of shows and I'll learn a new thing, and maybe this will help me de-school." You know, because I've got these bad habits or these obstacles to learning or these obstacles to freedom. It might have been created by school, but you know, here's something that can alleviate that. In my video work, I've been chronicling the problems of government school and the history of the problems of government school.
Yeah.
And the more I realize that, you know, with over 95% of everybody in this country having gone through 15,000 hours of the government school system, it's creating these distortions in things that we call the free market, right? But there isn't really as much freedom in these areas as we want there to be, because the people who are, you know, going into these markets to buy things or to trade have been so schooled. And I've been really down on what I guess a lot of people on the left call consumerism, right? Kind of mindless consumerism. And, you know, looking at obesity and you know, short-term satisfaction, long-term be damned kind of thinking. And, you know, I feel like I've been a little bit down in the dumps.
I kind of get what you're saying. I mean, I remember this happened to me some years ago. I was sitting around at a pool and in my own subdivision and looking at sort of bourgeoisie, you know, just consume and eat and talk about nothing and being sort of disturbed by the whole scene, you know, that freedom seems to be going down the tubes and these people are just sort of luxuriating in their own material decadence and nobody seems to care. I mean, maybe I'm not sure if I'm perfectly characterizing the way you're feeling, but I remember feeling that at the time. But you know, I think it's important to look at institutional considerations here. Like a major reason for what you're describing comes down to the money. The dollar, the nationalization of the money was a catastrophe for civilization. It's led people to be much more short-term thinking. They feel like they should just accumulate as much as possible without thinking about long-term values. You know, and it's depressing to watch. At the same time, you know, the question is, what are we going to do about it? I mean, we can sit around in despair. But in the case of, you know, that anonymous developer named Satoshi Nakamoto, he reinvented the monetary system, you know, based on cryptography, you know, and it's now challenging central banks of the world. I mean, we underestimate the impact of innovation, I think. And people who own Bitcoin are very interesting. They have a different value system. Instead of just thinking only about spending, which is what an inflated currency causes you to do, owners of Bitcoin think about saving, you know, which changes the way they go about life. They look at all the material possessions they have as a trade-off relative to maybe earning more money through holding Bitcoin. Do you understand what I mean? I mean, the money changes the culture. And I think in many ways the government has destroyed our culture through its inflated monetary system. So
yeah,
I'm very excited about the amazing way in which Bitcoin itself has reinvented our idea and our understanding of money. And that reinvention can actually change the culture and change society. So we have to be solutions-based. The answer is out there, but we have to be creative in finding it. That's, I guess, my main message. And that's the reason I started Liberty.me. I believe that we can find the answers, but we have to have a platform to do it. And that's what I want to create.
That's an interesting perspective, talking about the money aspect of it, because I think I often suffer from something that I've called the PETA effect, or I sometimes call it the Al Sharpton effect, where my niche is the school thing, right? So when I observe bad things happen in the world, I immediately say, well, how is school to blame for this, you know?
You know, the fun thing about the school issue, I mean, I think it's so great that you're doing this, because, I mean... Like, I think you're kind of alone in trying to draw attention to the real serious problem of compulsory schooling. I mean, essentially, people have been in jail, you know, for the first 18 years of their lives, you know, for a good 100 years. That's bound to have some terrible consequences. So I think it's brilliant that you're focusing on this. The problem is not just public schooling. It's compulsory schooling.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting issue because... As I say, not many people have talked about it. I mean, there's a lot of sort of reform plans for school choice or whatever, but doesn't really get to the issue. And the issue is the force involved. It's the compulsion. And
yeah.
I have a particular resentment against, you know, the fact. I mean, I think it's a violation of human rights to have laws that prevent people from being able to work, for example. And that's the world we live in. I mean, the state is forcing people not to engage in remunerative, valuable employment, and instead sit in these little cages where they get indoctrinated with state propaganda. I mean, that's the world we live in. That's our world right now. And it's an injustice and it's evil.
Yeah. And the more I learned about the history and the intentions behind the school system, really by a group of people who are very progressive, John Taylor Gatto often refers to them as the true believers. The pedagogy of compulsory schooling in the 20th century really seems to be, the inculcation of dependence and a lack of self-sufficiency. So when you, and this is kind of been my feeling about how this has created distortions in what could be a free market, that, the iPhone is great. The iPad is great. Do people look at it and say, oh, great, something to drown my sorrows and distract me from life? Or do they say, here's a tool that I can use to make my life better and subsequently make the world a little bit better? And so I mean, that's the cynicism. I think when you mentioned the iPhone, it triggered it for me because I've watched people, really depend on them. But
One of the fun things I like to do as a writer is draw attention to the fact that these gizmos that people have are given to them by the free market. Mm-hmm. People don't really have that consciousness,
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So I like to point this out. The government didn't do this for you. I mean, this is entirely a consequence of the market. It's a beautiful thing. But I don't know. I mean, something. Even if people don't entirely appreciate it, the point is that we're seeing the breakdown of the old order, by which I mean the government's communication technology. Back in the 1930s, when FDR was the American dictator, basically, he was the only one that really had access to communication. People would sit around their radios and listen to his fireside chats. Now nobody pays any attention to this whatsoever. And that's a beautiful thing. We're seeing the breakdown of a system. I mean, nobody even cares about the news anymore, This is one of the fun things. We're living through the age of the breakdown of the nation state. And I for one, like it. I mean, the neoconservatives don't like it. Social democratic liberals and progressives don't like it, but I just revel in it, every single day. I think it's really fun to see the nation state decomposing and sort of falling apart and people throwing themselves into their own lives and their own concerns at the expense of, the nation, the good of the people, to hell with it. I mean, that was a goofy 20th century experiment and I'm ready for it to be over.
Gosh, I hope you're right. It seems like there has been a dramatic change that I've observed in the last 10 or 12 years, where after 9/11, there was nothing people needed more than their televisions and the government. And it seems like that has changed a lot in the last decade.
Yeah, these are revolutionary times. Absolutely. And I wish we'd sort of recognize this. And we're living through a technological revolution that is way more significant than the Industrial Revolution itself. And it's destroying the old structures in the same way the Industrial Revolution did. We're gradually taking apart the consensus of the 20th century in favor of the state management of society. And actually the government and its leaders are actually quite panicked about this. John Kerry, Secretary of State, said this, I think a couple months ago. He said something like, it's very difficult to manage this world, govern this world with the internet.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. The world is not governable anymore. And that's all very good news, I think.
Well, yeah.
The collapse and decline, the decline and collapse of the nation state is going to be messy and intriguing and contain a lot of anomalies, and it's going to be a fun thing to chronicle and watch. I'm enjoying it, every day. I feel like in some sense I'm in the peanut gallery just watching this on the stage, but and this is why I started liberty.me. I really want to move into the action and just push it in directions that hasn't gone yet. So
Sure.
So what do you want the listeners to do after listening to this podcast?
Oh, well, listen, I've got this, I've been building and building. We probably won't release until about March 1st, I think. But we've got a kind of pre-subscription campaign that you can go to and go to the Indiegogo. You can go to liberty.me and click through the Indiegogo campaign. You can pre-subscribe, get in on the ground floor and get sort of cool things. We've got a lot of bling available. watch the videos, you know, sort of get a sense of what we're doing. And I would welcome you to come aboard as a contributor at any level, small or large or whatever. And like I say, we're about, you know, 2/3 of the way through our funding campaign.
All right. You sir, are an expensive guest because last time we had you on the show, we signed up for a gold subscription at the Laissez-Faire Book Club. And so I guess now we've got to go sign up for liberty.me. And I can't wait to see what you sell us next time.
And really, I would say to people, you know, this is really the way I feel about this. I mean, I'm so confident about this project that I'm not asking anybody to take any kind of leap into the unknown. I mean, I feel very, very good that I've got an idea here that's going to change everything. And I would welcome you now or later. Eventually, I think I can provide enough value to make it worth everybody's time.
I'm very interested in checking it out. I'm very, very excited to see where it goes. So do we want to spend some time talking about this film?
Why don't we? I mean, this is a kind of a controversial issue. The issue is Wolf of Wall Street. The state has a unique sort of feature to it, namely that it's able to get away with mass coercion legally. And Wall Street and the private sector is not, except to the extent it allies itself with the government. So yeah, between the two, we have to recognize that, you know, what is a necessary and sufficient condition for wrecking society? And I would say that is the state. It's not finance capitalism.
No, absolutely.
And that's a subtle point, but and I think Rothbard would certainly agree with this, you know. It's not as if Wall Street creates a state, you know, or sustains it. It's in a way, you know, the state is what sustains the private criminality, the cartels and the corruption.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that.
To put it in a way our younger demographic might understand, don't hate the player, hate the game.
Okay, so that's, I find this more and more on podcasts. I take up way too much time saying something that somebody else can say in a much shorter space. That's exactly it. And I don't think that the left quite gets this point. I mean, I find myself arguing with people a lot. You know, they'll come to me and, you know, they'll say, well, look, how can you favor capitalism? Look at all the corruption of the bailouts in 2008. And, you know, and I recognize this and I see this. But the question is, you know, sort of what enables this, you know? It's not as if the corporate financial capital enables the state to exist. It's almost the reverse in a sense that, you know, the corruption is made possible only by the existence of government. If it weren't for that, it doesn't mean corruption would go away. You know,
right.
It would always be there, but at least there'd be a check on it. The government sort of legitimizes and gives life to the most corrupt elements in society by itself and enabling that in the private sector, protecting them, bailing them out when they get in trouble, that sort of thing. This is an important ideological difference between libertarianism and, you know, what you might just call sort of, you know, street level leftism.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I talk to a lot of people on the left, and they certainly acknowledge the existence of bad people in the world. Unfortunately, they think the only thing they ever sought control over is the Republican Party, you know, and you know, I try to explain, and we were talking about this before you joined us, that they recognize, I think, the existence of this web that I'm talking about, and maybe there is money through lobbying, through the military-industrial complex, through a very bizarre and, you know, in many ways corrupt financial services industry. The state is becoming a weapon that allows this conduit to suck money away from, you know, not just middle class people, but people making a couple hundred thousand, a few million dollars a year to these interests that are connected to the government, you know. And the only solution that the left ever offers is like, well, how can we make that conduit wider and the suction stronger, right? By expanding the power of the state.
I'm always amazed by this, actually. I mean, the sheer incredible naivety of the left, that they think that somehow all problems can be solved by giving more power to the people who are causing the problem in the first place. I mean, I don't understand it. It frustrates me just so much to hear. And I try to, you know, embed myself in a world that has, you know, different perspectives than I have. And it always shocks me, you know. It's like, I mean, what is your sense? I mean, why do people sort of miss this point? Is it because for many people, the state is just not part of the consciousness? They don't understand that it really is a separate entity within society. They've not learned the basic message of Albert Jaynock you know, the great theorists of the past, that the state is a violent institution that uses different means than the rest of society, or what's going on there?
Okay, well, I think they're introduced to the world by spending 15,000 hours being educated by government employees. That's, you know, one strike against reason. Many the people who will go on to participate in the political conversation after that usually have some form of higher education, which in many cases is worse. And that I'm focusing on people who are participating in the political conversation, because people on the right are just as bad when they're in power. You know, what drove me initially towards the left was the first administration of George Bush, when I was becoming politically aware. And then I saw the 2004 Republican convention was just the most power drunken orgy of we don't give a shit. We are in charge kind of attitude, and doing it in New York to exploit 9/11 and just, you know, all of these things. I was deeply disturbed by that to the point that I at the time was probably referring to myself as a Democrat. Most people don't care. Most people, I think, just from my point of view, as far as the education piece of it, we learn in grades 1 through 6 this magical story about our country. It's the greatest thing ever. It's a savior to the world. Look at all these heroic. Frankly, kids, you've got nothing to worry about. You're living in the best place. Case closed. Grades 7 through 12 are filled with such monotony, boredom, worksheet completion, dates, terms, that after 6 months, so you have the initial fantasy that tells people they never have to worry about this again. You spend the next years being bored to tears by the subject of history, civics, and politics, and that you never want to participate in it again. So for most people, thinking about the state or participating in conversations about government or politics is just a headache that most people want to avoid.
That's very interesting. But at the same time, people are naturally, I think, disposed to recoil against injustice, you know, war, corruption, and violence. And these are all mainly promoted by the government. So why aren't they anti-government? Do you think it has something to do with people's fear of a world without government? I mean, I've noticed this recently. Like, I mean, it's sort of a big public anarchist, right?
Yeah.
And people confront me all the time. They go, well, you know, how can you favor anarchism? Because horrible things will happen. And I'm like, okay, what? And the answers are all over the map, you know? And almost unpredictable. Like, well, there'll be massive environmental despoliation. There'll be sexism unleashed. Racism will take over and oppress minorities. You know, the various nightmare scenarios. Rapacious corporations will loot us, you know, at every turn. And I almost feel like sometimes people's attachment to statism is almost a kind of a least bad solution for them. You know, it's like they want the government to do one thing that they really care about, protect the environment or defend women's rights or something, protect us from foreign invasion, whatever the thing may be. And they're willing to tolerate a horrible situation of the government basically looting everybody and creating social violence and catastrophe all over the place for fear of some unknown thing called freedom that they're really worried about, actually. What do you think about that?
Well, it might be a question of responsibility. You know, like, I have two brothers, right? They're both younger than me. Now, I have more time to spend contemplating these things than my brother, who's, the finance manager at a Mercedes dealership in Massachusetts,
or my other brother, who's the general manager of a camper store in Connecticut. And they both have two kids. And they both have people answering to them. And they both have people that they have to answer to. And that's just a life that I never wanted. I never saw myself fitting into to, but that's just me. And these are their, those are their lives. Those are their responsibilities. So for me to say, you know, at dinner on Sunday night when we all get together, hey guys, you know what? I want to get rid of the state, you know? So from now on, you know, you'll have to figure out the roads and, you know, the defense thing. They're just like, you know, why don't you go home? Why don't you leave us alone? I don't have enough responsibilities already. I've got two kids. I'm the manager of, you know, a multi-million dollar business. Can't like all that stuff just be taken care of? And can't I just pursue, you know, my own life? Can I spend time with my wife? Can I worry about my kids? Part of it might be people don't have, they've never been taught problem solving methodologies. They are also, they grow up through the schools and through society like, hey, welcome to the world. It's already buzzing, just buzzing along just fine. If you're polite and quiet, you can join us. You know, I mean, that's kind of the thing. And John Kozel, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was a public school teacher in Boston. He wrote The Night is Dark and I'm Far from Home. He's a real lefty, but he had some good criticisms of the education system. Yeah. And he said, you know, this is the thing. Kids are introduced to society that's already functioning just fine without them. If they're polite and well-behaved, we will welcome them to it. That is the message of school and society, right? Mm-hmm. And the impact of that at such a young age, and I think also the message of secondary school and university and mass media is, hey, we've got some experts. Lucky you, you don't have to think at all because here are the experts. So right. I think it's a compendium of all of these different factors. Like people
the non-engagement in real life, right? I mean, this is a very interesting thing the government has done. It's sort of taken, you know, everybody, all, you know, at their most impressionable ages and detached them from society, taken them outside of the sort of normal functioning of the social order, which is commercial, which is a lot of things, but and basically shove them into prison-like environments, you know, and that can't be good. I mean, but the knowledge that they're missing is as shocking as what they're learning. Do you understand what I mean? What they're being denied, the access to the knowledge that they're being denied because of the opportunity cost of not being involved in, you know, commercial life or regular social order sort of stuff, is as debilitating and awful as what they're actually learning in the classroom itself.
Absolutely. And especially when you consider that what they're learning is nothing. And I had a discussion, I have a 14-year-old nephew, and there was a confrontation with all the adults about the importance of grades, you know, and I'm there and I just said to him, frankly, to my nephew, I said, look, if you want to play this game, Osborne pointed this out months ago on the show, that this is very much a game, you know, and if you recognize that you're playing it, you can be okay. You know, if you recognize what school is about and you're there to get, you know, a lottery ticket called a diploma that you can then, you know, toss into the college admissions sweepstakes, then as long as you do understand that you are not your grades, you are not what these strange government employee adults think of you or tell you you are. There are ways to survive school, but the best thing to do is to get out of school if you can. And I, you know, I've tried to explain this to my brother. There's no reason, and that brings me back to the point of not learning anything. I asked my nephew in front of everyone, I said, do you know how to read? He said, yes. I said, can you write a little bit? He said, yes. I said, can you add, subtract, multiply, and divide? And he said, yes. And I turned to the adults and I said, tell me one other thing you remember learning that you still use in life today in school that this child does not know how to do.
See, this is the problem. Basically, after the age of 10 or 11, it's just babysitting. And, you know, and that's just horrible. What a fantastic waste of a person's life. I mean, I feel so terrible for people. I mean, especially these days with technology is making kids so smart, so early, so sophisticated. And we don't let them work before the age of 16, 17.
You know?
Yeah. So what the hell are they supposed to do between the ages of 10 and 17, actually? It's amazing. So they throw themselves into idiotic pastimes like... Well, we know what people do, and it's grim, actually. Idle hands do the devil's work, essentially.
Yeah.
And we congratulate ourselves as a society. Oh, we've abolished child labor, you know. Well, what the hell? This is the worst thing that ever happened, actually. I mean, why are we still congratulating ourselves on this? We put children in cages. We put them in the government classrooms, and that's, you know, fulfillment of human rights. Well, wait a minute. How come... You know, every high school is filled with, you know, dreary, detached, unsocialized, despairing kids in that case. I mean, is this really the fulfillment of human rights? Maybe they'd be happy you're working at Chick-fil-A at the age of 12. I think it would be a fantastic world. You know, I was just the other day at a pack mail service. It's one of these great private enterprises, you know, that substitutes for the post office, which I hate to go to because it just makes you feel oppressed. So I go to these private services, and I went into one of them, a family-owned business, and there was like a 12-year-old working, okay?
Yeah.
And you know, I don't want to come across like an enforcement agent, you know, but I, you always have to ask these questions very carefully. And I said to the person who seemed to be the owner, I said, you know, I think it's so wonderful that this young boy over here is just a fantastic employee. I mean, he's so competent and so conscientious. How old is he? And she kind of, you know, sort of recalled slightly, she goes, well, he's 12. And I said, listen, I think it's amazing that he's getting this kind of work experience, and I really congratulate you on it. I'm happy for him, but can I ask you how he gets around, you know, what seem to be these sort of oppressive regulations, you know, that would seem to actually forbid this from happening? And she said, with a little bit of reticence, because, you know, when you ask these kind of questions, people imagine you might be actually a, you know, bureaucrat or something.
Sure.
And she said, well, actually, he's my son. So there's an exemption in law for family businesses.
Oh.
Yeah. So but I had a sense of like, wow. So that's the way you get privileges in this society. You have to, you know, you sort of work your way in, you know, to under these rarefied conditions under which, you know, you can own a business and then you can employ your direct family members. But beyond that, you can't employ anybody else. And I thought, you know, this boy is the luckiest boy in the world, you know?
Yeah.
Far from being exploited, he's actually getting amazing real-life work experience working at a pack mail shop in the middle of the Christmas season. You know, it's just a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. But I guess my point is that everybody should be entitled to that right. You know, that we shouldn't just allow only the children of the business owners to have that right.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And as far as child labor is concerned, I mean, there seems to be this myth constructed that the industrialists were driving around with an ox cart and picking up kids and bringing them to the factory. Parents put kids in the factory. You know, that was a parental decision. That was not compulsory. And I think that today parents have the same choice. Unfortunately, the only product of the schools is jobs for, frankly, mediocre people, you know, at the kids' expense. So a lot of the skills now, certainly are there 19th century industrial horror stories? Yeah, I believe a lot of those stories are true. I believe the working conditions for young people and adults were far superior then than they were 100 years prior to that. I don't think that that's the standard that, you know, all work should be evaluated by. Well, look how bad things are, you know, then. And now we have kids, you know, properly helmeted, filling out worksheets. And that's a better life for them because they're not learning self-sufficiency. They're not getting any independence. There's very little sense of self-efficacy. And it's a terrible carrots and sticks system. So I find you know, the schooling system of today, more destructive than the factory labor system of 100 years before that. So, I mean,
that's right. I mean, I understand why people thought they were liberating, and it may have been innocent error, but we're looking at 100 years later now. You know what I mean?
Right.
Kids are very smart. They want to work. They want to make money. Why do we deny them choice? You know, why do we continue to do this and force them into situations they basically want to escape? You know, I mean, we have a kind of very arcane system. This word truancy, you know, which basically means, you know, the kid just wanted to be away from jail for a few hours or a day. You know, but it's illegal. You know, it's a very strange system we have. Why does nobody complain about this? I mean, it's funny. There's like a mass hysteria against the idea of child labor, but no worry whatsoever against actual child slavery, which is what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think we talked about this the last time you were on the show as well, that that's total compulsion. And it's not a service for kids because, you know, there are kids who are old enough who know what's for their own good and what isn't for their own good. And you can't call something for kids a service if they absolutely hate it and are forced to be there, right? That's a weird word to use, is service. But this goes back to what I was saying earlier in the conversation, what John Taylor Gatto called the true believers. You know, the people who shaped the school system really believed that they had insights into how humanity worked and how humanity needed to work in the future, namely John Dewey, great example of that. Horace Mann, another one. The people who shaped the American school system, they believed that they were, you know, doing God's work. And I think that there were more nefarious interests. I mean, everybody tried to control school. Everybody lined up. They said, oh, you take the kids and you just keep them there and you control what goes into their minds. That would help me. I'd like to be in on that. So there are a variety of public and private interests that lined up out the door and around the corner to be in control of that, you know, from the United Nations to the Ku Klux Klan, as I've said before. You know, they all wanted a piece of that action. So when you see these incredibly powerful institutions that can produce such a positive effect for vested interests, you know, school is an example of that. The mainstream media is an example of that. Hollywood is an example of that. I think to a certain degree, the stock market is an example of that, that when people see that kind of power in potentia, they will try to control it. There will always be interests vying for control of powerful mechanisms like that. And that's something that people need to understand.
But don't you think this is an old paradigm? I just don't believe that this stuff is sustainable. I mean, education has been reinvented in the digital age. You know, we've got, you know, amazing platforms that teach you everything you need to teach. Homeschooling has exploded. Charter schools and cottage schooling is going crazy. Even public schooling itself is kind of under severe pressure in a way. So that it's just not really sustainable. I don't believe it. I mean, we're living in a digital age. I mean, the idea that John Dewey would continue to rule our world, you know, 100+ years after his, you know, idiotic musings changed the world. I don't believe it's sustainable. I mean, I think we're going through a dramatic paradigm shift.
I hope I appreciate your optimism, because I'm somebody who, you know, looks at history and says, God, I think we're still trapped in the hypnosis by and large of like German idealism. You know, we're still, you know, our school system came from Central Europe, and this was a philosophical school of thought who said,
no, I think it's true. But you look back at Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It came out in 1962. I mean, he looked at the sweep of history and really examined how change occurs. And He had basically three stages. You had a pre-paradigmatic stage where everybody's confused about what we should be doing. And then there's a consensus that gradually emerges that may be right or wrong. And it sustains itself for a very long period of time. And then it breaks down. The consensus breaks down, not because of gradual evolution, but because there are factual anomalies that are entering into the system that contradict the prevailing consensus. And when those anomalies become like overwhelming, there are dramatic sort of new thoughts and new changes that are occurring that break down and destroy the old consensus and shatter the institutions and allow us to enter into a new pre-paradigmatic stage, preparing the way for a new consensus. Mm-hmm. So that's his model. And if you look at that in terms of the last, say, 150 years, I mean, the late 19th century was a pre-paradigmatic stage where we had gigantic amount of economic growth as a result of free enterprise, but people didn't entirely understand the cause. And there was a consensus in the early part of the 20th century around the state as a organizing tool of society. And so we get public schooling, we get the Federal Reserve, we get income taxes, we get central planning, socialism, Bolshevik Revolution, all the rest of this crap that we've been living with all these years. World wars and the New Deal and the Holocaust and the Gulag and, you know, all this crap.
Yeah.
But now, if you look at the way the world works, there's too many anomalies that are tearing down the statist consensus. I mean, we've got the failure of the drug war, the failure of public schooling, the failure of Obamacare. Every war the U.S. has entered in the last 20 years has been a gigantic flop. I mean, the state is failing all around. So yeah. If Thomas Kuhn is right, what we're living in the middle of is a kind of a breakdown of a failed consensus, and we're entering into a pre-paradigmatic stage. I really believe that seems to be what's going on.
So that being said, I mean, what do you think if you had to forecast the next decade or two would hold?
Yeah, so I think my forecast is wildly implausible. And I say that for a reason, because I think we've lived over the last 10 years of the wildly implausible. I mean, nobody 10 years ago would have predicted what the world we're living in now with smartphones and instantaneous communication. Even this podcast that's taking place right now, nobody would have predicted was even possible, you know, 10 years ago. I mean, even every person has the means within his or her disposal to talk to the world with anyone instantly. It's an amazing revolution. So I think we have every reason to be just like reckless with our predictions. And I think over the next 10 years, we're not even going to recognize the world today that we're going to see in 10 years from now. I think it's going to be a world of radical individual empowerment, a breakdown of the nation state, mass disobedience, a clamor on the part of the remnants of the nation state to sort of catch up, make sense of the world, contain and preserve what they can, in a largely declining and shattering world of statism and the emergence of human liberty. I don't think it's going to be pretty. I think it's going to be a little bit rough, you know, but and filled with toil and disruption and disobedience and confusion. But I think we're going to emerge on the other end in a world of anarchism, decentralized nation states, people's detachment from the nation, more secure property rights thanks to technology and cryptography, a new world monetary system built by private enterprise, actually. This is where I see things going. I really believe it, and I'm happy to be part of it. I mean, I'm glad to be as a spectator and participant in this, because I really hate what's happened over the last 100 years. I think it's grim and horrible, and I would like to see it shattered.
Yeah.
So long as I can live and breathe in this world, I want to apply all my efforts to kind of pushing what I see as inevitable to happening sooner and more radically and dramatically than it otherwise would have.
Absolutely. And, you know, I look out in the world, and this is where things start to get a little Alex Jonesy for me, but there's something that I see that's very encouraging, but it's also frightening. And there seems to be a lot of signs that the state is kind of gearing up for its big finish. you know, and it's not going to be a peaceful one because, you know, it's not an institution or an operation that attracts a mass of people who are go, okay, you know, we were wrong. I think that right up until the very finish, unfortunately, it is probably going to push forward with the tactics and tools that it's used all along. But what appears to be happening is there are a couple of fronts where it seems like there's an effort to hedge against human conscience, right? So we have the NSA, and I actually don't believe that the NSA is terribly interested in collecting information on people like you or me. I believe that the NSA is interested in collecting information on people who are influential.
This is how all states work. You know,
not that we're not influential, but just like people who are influential on a mass scale. Like,
listen, I'm with you. I mean, I want to be so influential. I want to be so influential that the FBI comes in and bangs on my door. You know,
yeah.
And it doesn't seem to be happening. Actually, I keep trying. You know. After the Silk Road was taken down and I found in my email correspondence that I had a long correspondence with the Dread Pirate Roberts, I wrote many articles about this, hoping that the FBI would come investigate me and like confiscate my computer and whatever. They never even bothered me. I mean, it's proof to me I don't matter, actually.
Well, within this school of thought, you are definitely within the influential elite for sure, you know, but like you're at the top in this corner. This philosophical corner, but when I'm talking influential, and no offense, I'm talking about like a Justin Timberlake, right?
Absolutely. So, no, these are the real people.
Somebody who tweets and
Black, right?
Yeah.
Right.
and you know, collecting information on politicians, like people who might say, wait a minute, this goes too far, or I need to speak out against this. And there is a collection of data that says not so fast because, you know, Don't let your conscience get the best of you because, you know, we've collected a lot of information that will certainly ruin your career if you, I mean, you can even see it on a smaller scale with somebody like Snowden. Like Snowden, as soon as he spoke out, it was character assassination. Character assassination is extremely powerful. How could you ever take a person, who cares what this person thinks? He dropped out of high school. And, you know, the other hedge against conscience that I see is drones. You know, it's so high. It might get to a point where, you know, the government has to do something where soldiers say, well, I wouldn't do that. But all you need is one guy with a flying robot to do it, you know, and you've removed conscience by and large from the equation. And, you know, those things scare me. But seeing the egregious violence ramp up, it says to me that people understand that the state's days are numbered. And I agree that it would be certainly a rough patch, but I look forward to what the other side of that is if I live to see it. You know,
we will live to see it. I mean, we're seeing it right now. I mean, that's what's interesting to me. I mean, you know, every time I tweet, every time I'm able to post anywhere, and even this podcast, I mean, it thrills me to be part of this new world. And this is why I've started this company. I want to like push out the edge. I want to do amazing things. I want to be part of the revolution. I want to be part of the solution rather than just the grousing, you know, peanut gallery. You know, I want to see amazing things happen. I mean, really, even public schooling itself is breaking down, you know, with a lot of homeschooling. We have to recognize this. We have to recognize just what it means for us that things like Khan Academy exist, you know? I mean, 10 years ago, it didn't. Now it does. That's a glorious thing. So, you know, let's look at the miracles all around us and just cheer and see what's coming.
I like that. I think that's a nice finish. We've taken up an hour and 40 minutes of your time. Which
I didn't mean to take so much. Are you both going to be at in New Hampshire? Jason, will you be there?
I am in New Hampshire for sure.
Okay, so you're going to be at the Freedom Forum?
Liberty Forum?
Liberty Forum,
I don't know. I hadn't even thought about it because I didn't notice you on the list.
I am coming. No, I'm like a speaker.
Well, then I will be there.
But it's an exciting opportunity, don't you think, to sort of crowdsource information? I'm so excited to come back. I mean, it was my first trip there. It was a big deal to me. actually. It was a revelation to see how people are working to implement liberty in their lives. And I feel like it kind of changed my whole intellectual direction, you know. So I can't wait to come back. I mean, the way it goes is like I've got International Students for Liberty Conference in D.C., which is like 3,000 kids at this point, right? And then I'm going to Manhattan. And I'm speaking at a big Bitcoin conference in Manhattan, the financial district, and straight from there to Liberty Forum.
Nice. Now, it was fun to listen to you talk about Bitcoin earlier in the show, because last time you were on this show was the day you bought your first Bitcoin.
So I don't know it's like, you know, for an evangelical, you'd say that was the day you accepted Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior. It changed my life, really. I remember that.
I will say that was the last time I bought Bitcoin, too, because it was that machine that made it all possible.
That's right.
It's so complicated. Like, I still, after all this time, don't know how to go online and grab myself a Bitcoin. But those guys had that machine right there, and I just took all the money I had in my wallet and shoved it in the machine and got Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It was great. I hope they have it again, because I'll get some more.
You're so lucky. You're in, you know, to live in the middle of the revolution. It's just great. I mean, I dreaded Bitcoin in a way, because I thought it was another goddamn file type. You know, it was like, okay, I've lived through so many file types, I just can't deal with another one. And I was surrounded by geeks at this Liberty Forum, and they forced me in a way, not forced me, but they prevailed upon me to get interested in Bitcoin. And it just opened up a whole world for me. You know, I mean, it's very interesting. We need to be disruptive as individuals. We need to take on tasks we find unpleasant slightly, because sometimes we discover things that are just more fabulous than we ever imagined. So, you know, as you know, I held a Bitcoin conference myself. I've written, you know, probably, I don't know, 150 articles on the topic. You know, I have one today on Bitcoin Magazine. I can't stop writing about it or thinking about it. And in many ways, New Hampshire is the sort of world center of Bitcoin activity.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in a way. So I hope I see both in what, like a month or something.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we could do another. We could do another sit down. And
can't wait.
Yeah,
that would be so great, huh? I mean, if you would invite me, I would love to be there.
You have an open invite. You know, send me an email and say, you know, I want to be on School Sucks today, and I'll make it happen. You're one of our favorite guests. And people really enjoyed you on the show before. And it was very effortless. You know, sometimes it's hard. This format is hard when you don't know people that well and you don't know their rhythm. And I felt like that conversation, because when you have a guest for the first time, when you're interviewing people, I know you've interviewed people before, you know, you never really know how it's going to go, but
it sometimes happens, right?
It was effortless. And, you know, we kept you here today for what Hollywood says is the perfect length of a movie, an hour and 40 minutes.
I've enjoyed it so much. I mean, I learned from both of you. I appreciate your having me on, and I hope we can talk in a month, and we'll get together. Now, it's going to be amazing.
Now, Jeffrey, let me know if you fly into Logan International. Let me know. I will come pick you up and take you by the hat store before heading to the Liberty Forum.
In Boston. I will fly into Logan. And is this really going to happen?
If you let me know, I'll pick you up.
I don't want to be like romantic or, you know, excessive in this whole thing. But I mean, I have some sense that you know way more about this topic than I do, and I want to be your protege, your student.
Oh my gosh, I just love to take people to the hat store. I took our friend Gardner Goldsmith last week, got him his first hat.
Let's do it. I mean, I have this beaver felt hat coming in from San Francisco. I think it's going to arrive on Monday or Tuesday.
Beaver? I thought you said you were getting a rabbit felt.
What did I say? Beaver? No. The only reason I got that wrong slightly was that when I said rabbit, he corrected me and called it a hare.
Oh.
So I was a little reluctant to say a rabbit, but of course it's a hare hat.
My hat people say the word rabbit, so I don't know if it's the same thing or... If they don't know what they're talking about, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't understand this. So, like, why is my hat made of hair rather than a rabbit? I don't get this. But anyway, I'm willing to defer to the great expert, you know, at the Cable Car cool beers in San Francisco. So,
and this is, yeah,
not the same or anything compared to your great Boston people. So let's go. Let's do it. I'll fly into Logan and we'll go to the hat store and we'll have a blast.
Awesome.
And then the benefit for Osborne is you get to Liberty Forum, right? People are talking. They're saying, look at Jeffrey Tucker. He looks dashing. And Osborne overhears it. He says, do you know he's one of my fashion students? So everybody wins after, you know, a visit to the hat store. All right, so we'll let you go. We'll see you in a month. Thank you again so much for your time and for participating in our conversation. We will talk again soon, sir.
It's lovely to be with you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.